You're listening to Beyond the Melody, a podcast that dives into the myths of musicians, artists, comedians, writers, and pretty much anyone who craves to be creative. My name is Brian Mello, and I'm a singer-songwriter from Hamilton, Ontario. I know how unforgiving an artist's journey can be, but I also know that inspiration can come from just about anywhere. I'm sitting down with people who know how to dream big. Let's explore their impact and how it's even bigger. Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Beyond the Melody. On today's podcast, we have renowned musician and songwriter who has worked with the likes of Tommy Swick, Brian Griffith, and also the Celtic folk band Poor Angus. I'm talking about my good friend, Mr. Joe Gunther.
How you doing, Brian?
What's up, brother?
Oh, not too much, man. Not too much.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much for making the time, brother.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I gotta say, man, you know, I'm here at your place right now, and we were talking off air, but I'm a little jealous about this vintage record collection that you have sitting behind you, man.
I love it. I love records. I always have loved records, and I will continue to. They're expensive as hell now.
I know. It's an expensive habit, but I can't wait until I get a setup like yours. And I mean, you want to talk about a fucking collection. This is impressive. Have you always been reluctant to kind of go into that digital world?
I'm not reluctant. I just don't like it.
No,
that it's just that simple. I don't know why I don't like it. I like the convenience of it.
Sure.
But I don't know. There's no fun in it. It's way more fun to sit down with a record. Like I showed you that poster in the George Harrison record.
How cool is that?
I mean, it's
right?
Amazing. It's super cool. And you just can't get that full experience. I like to read the liner notes. I like it when there's cool art. I like it when there's books and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
It's a lot more fun, I think.
Do you think that I know the vintage world right now, or the vinyl world, I should say, is still kind of niche. Do you think there's going to be more and more of a resurgence of people? Because I feel with me, I feel like I'm kind of working a bit backwards, where I kind of almost got in the habit of sort of what everybody else was doing, the convenience.
Yeah.
I'm missing the nostalgic of opening up the record, feeling, you know, really feeling those great records the way they were meant to be listened to.
And you interact with it is the word I'm looking for. You interact with it more because you've got sides to the record. You got to get up and flip it. You've got to, you know, and it's kind of like driving a standard.
Yeah.
You know, you're interacting with the car a little bit more, and you find all these cool little details in driving. The same way with records. You tend to listen to them more. You don't tend to put on records for the background. Well, I do. I've just got music playing all the time.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But, there's something more, I guess it's official somehow, you know.
Yeah.
There's something official about having the record stamped, you know. It's a lot of fun. I really like it. And of course it sounds great. If you get a good clean record, it sounds amazing.
So good, man. It's like you're putting on some stuff for me here, and it's just like, it's just giving me more of that push of like, man, get the setup, get rolling with it. You know, like you said, I mean, it can be an expensive habit for guys like us that are just music nuts, and this is our world. But man, it's not something that you would regret. Just like,
well, and the other thing is, it'll last well beyond you if you take care of it.
Right?
You know, I mean, essentially, it's a piece of vinyl. You know,
right?
It's not going anywhere as long as you treat it well. You know, my son will get those records and probably sell them all or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if
it's rubbing off on him. I know. Yeah.
I'll tell you, his first record, I could actually show you, but his first record, I have it, and I've since replaced it with a newer copy of it because he was little. We got him a record player. I think he was 3 years old.
Yeah.
And it was Fats Domino.
Okay.
40 hits of Fats Domino. And he loved them. Absolutely loved him. And he's moved on since. There are other things that he likes, but he does have this rock and roll thing. He really likes Chuck Berry, and he really likes Fats Domino, and he absolutely adores Little Richard. So to me, I've done my job.
Yeah.
You know, there, well, you go, son. There's
right.
How you start, you know. Get into Elvis and a few of those guys later on. He loves the Beatles.
What do you think it is about those guys? Like everyone you just listed, it's like, it's timeless, man. Like it kind of doesn't matter if you were a kid in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and 90s and so on, but it still really affects people.
Absolutely.
Well, what do you think that is?
Well, because you're hearing the guy. In those days, recording was so primitive. You know, it was really, I mean, mixing was just moving a mic you know, back or forethoughts. I'm getting a little too much guitar. And they'd move the mic back a half a foot, you know. It was really, really based on individuals playing together, because you couldn't overdub, you couldn't edit, you couldn't do anything to it. Hound Dog, when Elvis did it, I forget how many takes, but it's 40 some odd takes that they did until they got that one. And that's how you did it. So you're hearing the real thing. The one of the coolest sets of recording of all time is Sun Studios Elvis Presley. Ugh. I have the thing behind. I'll play you some in a bit. But buddy, it is some of the coolest stuff on earth, because it's basic, right? That first band is Scotty Moore, Elvis, and Bill Black.
Yeah.
Right? There's no drummer. Any drumming, any percussion that you hear is people stomping and Bill slapping on the bass. You know?
Yeah.
And it's rocking stuff.
I know,
you
know.
And you got all those great parts. Like Elvis would be playing down here. He'd be playing like. And then Scotty would be.
So cool.
You know, and you'd get all these amazing parts. That solo's great. I love this. Right. Brilliant stuff. So I can't even good. Play it. I can't even play it. I haven't done that stuff for a long time, but it's just, there's so much life in it.
It feels like those parts, like you hear that with those really great songs, is they're dancing together.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like they're really, really, you're not just putting in another part in this song just for the sake of
because you have nothing else you can do.
Exactly.
There's no padding. You can't overdub an organ on later.
Yeah.
You know, which means if you're going to have an organ in the room, there better be a point to it. You know?
Exactly. There's a purpose to everything, right? Yeah. And I feel like early on in my career, I kind of got lost in that, into like the wall of sound.
Sure.
You know, and as I've gotten older, it's like, okay, wait a second, man. Less is more. And, you know, the music that you create is sometimes in between the notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
It is. It's really, really easy to get sucked into that nowadays, because you feel like that's what you're supposed to do. Guitar players get trapped in that all the time with giant bloody pedal boards. And I've had mine. It was affectionately dubbed the coffin, because it weighed something like 95 pounds or something like that when it was fully loaded.
Yeah.
It was absolutely hilarious. I don't remember exactly how big it was, but it was huge. It was like this, and it had two rows to it and two separate channels. So each row was a separate channel that would then link up, or I could run it stereo. And the mic stand, because I couldn't fit a mic stand around it because it was so big. The mic, I actually would take these off, or take the bass off and insert it into the pedal board.
That's
I made a little spot where you could do that.
So there wasn't a boom long enough to get
that's right. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I'd have this thing totally maxed out and leaning over, which of course would just fall over.
Yeah.
But the problem with stuff like that is that it's wildly impractical and it's very confusing.
Yeah.
You know, it means that I'm spending more time staring at the floor than I am actually playing the songs.
Good point.
You know, and it's very easy to get all messed up in all of that stuff, which is why guys like The Edge has one of the most amazing techs on earth in Dallas. You know, the guy's just amazing. But he has to be. You would have to be amazing to keep that stuff working and, you know, running the show.
Yeah,
properly.
Like watching It Might Get Loud or.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where obviously you're doing arenas, you're doing stadiums. He can't, like you said a second ago, be hitting the pedals to change the songs.
That's it.
But this guy's playing with them underneath the stage.
Yeah.
And actually changing all the sounds for The Edge. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like he can't miss a fucking note.
And can't see one another.
And can't see one another, exactly.
So you're doing it completely blind with just, you know, audio cues.
Yeah.
It's that's a hell of a job.
Right.
Imagine the pressure on those guys.
I know, right? Right.
I'll tell you who has the biggest high pressure moment of any person ever in the history of show business.
Who's that?
You ready for this? Paul McCartney's bass tech. I don't know if Paul still does this, but for years and years and years, anybody who saw him can back me up on this, and I think they got it on DVD as well.
Okay.
Paul would take off one of those original 60s Beatle basses at the end of the show, and they weigh very little, right? It's a hollow guitar, and he'd wave and, you know, everything like that, and he'd take the guitar like this and throw it about 15 feet or 20 feet It was not a close throw. It was a giant lob. And that tech had to catch that thing every single night. Can you imagine what that base is worth just in sentimental value, let alone what that thing means to the world? That's Paul's Beetle base.
Right.
You know, you cannot, and he never did, never dropped it. But you can imagine everything else in the room must be turned off at that point. That guy's focusing entirely on
I was going to say, chime stops.
Bass,
time is that Chariots of Fire kind of dun, 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 dun.
You know? Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Just make sure you got an empty bladder when you start that, you know.
Yeah, God, really.
Just brutal.
It's crazy.
But to Paul, it's just a bass. It's not that big a deal. I've got a couple more, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy, man. It's crazy. You know, one thing I learned about you, and, you know, we've been buddies for a long time, is that your dad was in this classic, like...
My dad and my stepdad.
Your stepdad, that's right. They were both in The Last Words.
Yeah, The Last Words.
And I was listening to all their music this week, man. It was so cool. And it was like that light bulb that hit my head. I'm like, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, I can see where Gunther gets his.
Oh, it's all over my family.
Man.
My mom used to work with Alice Cooper too. And Bob Ezrin
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, she was with Ezrin at the time. They were working together. And I'm not sure what her exact title would have been. But essentially, he was taking care of the music and she was taking care of the performers. So when they were doing Peter Gabriel's first album.
Yeah.
And Peter needed a certain keyboard delivered up to his hotel room. It was my mom who did it. Right? So she got to know all of those guys. You know?
Wow.
And Alice Cooper. They stayed in a house together for a while. Alice and his wife, Cheryl, and then Bob and my mom, you know,
and
was in on it. She was in there for all of that stuff. So music is really heavy in my family. And my dad was the drummer for The Last Words. So that's like mid 60s Yorkville stuff. And they had some tunes on the charts and everything else. And they're just really fun to listen to. And so it's there.
Yeah.
My dad's a huge fan of Levon Helm.
Okay.
One of his favorite drummers. And he still plays like that. You know, he's still got a shoulder when he plays, you know. And you can hear it. And what's really funny is when you're first finding your feet, you know, and you know how it is.
Yeah.
You listen back sometimes to old tapes and you feel, oh, wow, you know, that was pretty good. And other ones you listen back and you just go, oh, God, what are you doing with your voice? What are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, trying to sound like somebody else or whatever. My dad, there was a tape at one point. My dad's from Lunenburg in Nova Scotia.
Okay.
And there's a tape of him at the El Patio Coffee House in Yorkville. And when he's off the mic, he's talking with the Southern accent, right? He's got this kind of drawl to his voice. And what are you doing? Where's that coming from? And sure enough, when he heard it back later on, he's like, oh, God. I was hoping nobody had those on tape, you know.
Right.
But we all go through those phases.
Oh, man. I had that too. Like, apparently, every time I would go on the mic when I was first starting out, people thought, like, are you from New York?
Right.
I'm like, oh, dude, am I putting something on that I don't even realize? I'm like, oh, shit.
It's just in there.
It was just sort of in there, right? Yeah.
Me, it was Eric Clapton. Eric Clapton ruined my life for a period.
Why?
Because I was 13 when I started playing guitar, and I was, I think, 14 or 15 when the Unplugged album came out. And it just tore my head off. It was such a great record. And for learning how to play guitar, it was so cool because some of it was accessible. You know, he's playing Malted Milk and things like that. You know, I forget what key Malted Milk is even in, but he does Hey, Hey, which is an old Big Bill Brunsey thing.
Okay.
And it's got this thing called dead thumb. And dead thumbing is when you just on all four, you know.
Okay.
And it's not like a country rhythm where you'd be going, or a folk kind of rhythm, Travis picking kind of rhythm.
Yeah.
This is really strictly like this. And the tune goes.
So good, man.
You know, and you just go, what is going on in there?
So you're trying to learn that? You
know? Yeah. And then the solo for Layla, right, is one of the coolest solos. So it's in here. And it starts with this line that's like,
–
Something like that. And there's a line where he plays, what is the line? That's it. You know, and for those little things, I was just mesmerized, right? Well, then I'm getting into blues music. My dad's a big blues fan as well. We'd gone to the blues festival in 94. Right around that time, Clapton came out with From the Cradle. And if you've not heard From the Cradle, it's recorded entirely off the floor with a just an unbelievably good band, you know, Chris Stainton playing piano and this and that. And Clapton is on fire. He's just blazing through this record, right?
Yeah.
You can tell he's really happy and it really good vibes in the room and everything else. And he had been playing strats so consistently. And in this one, suddenly he's playing 335 and then he's playing a, you know, a big hollow body and this kind of stuff. Mm. And doing songs like Howlin' Wolf's 44 and, you know, Bessie Smith from back in the 30s. There ain't nothing I can do. Oh, nothing I can say, you know.
So good,
amazing
man.
Amazing stuff, man.
Yeah.
And just so the influence was so heavy as a young guitar player, because I'd come out of Nirvana and stuff like that, right? That was my first stuff that I was learning how to play.
Yeah.
And I was still really into that and still really into Alice Cooper and those kind of things. But this Clapton thing suddenly just exploded. And by the time I was playing with Brian, I was 18. And I was so wildly crazy in love with Clapton's playing that I couldn't get away from it when I played. And everybody said, oh, man, you sound a lot like Eric Clapton. And every time they did, I was like, oh, God damn it. I got to do something about this, you know.
Hey, not a bad guy to mimic, though,
no,
man.
No, for sure. But you those long bends and things. You know.
So good, man.
Fantastic guitar player. And David Gilmour, too, was the other guy with the really long bends when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
You know.
How about Dire Straits? Did you ever get into?
Oh, absolutely love it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Knopfler has a tune called Romeo and Juliet that is so ridiculously good that I don't even know what to do with it. You know, and I've played it live for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And I don't have a capo actually handy, but it's up here. It's in F. But the lick is like
yeah.
But it's way cooler because he's in this open tuning and stuff.
Man.
Love struck Romeo, sing the streets a serenade.
Great tune.
Laying everybody low with a love song that he made. He finds a streetlight, steps out of the shade, says something like, you and me, babe, how about it? You know.
Come on, man.
Amazing lyrics.
Man.
Absolutely amazing lyrics.
The thing that's like known around like the circle here where you know, all of us jam and gig together is you're known as like the library. So when it comes to like the musician that knows songs and remembers lyrics,
I don't know why that is. I've never understood
That's what my question was going to be. Like, is there's no trick. There's no exercise, no technique.
Repetition. If I like something, if you notice my record collection is not a little bit of everything. My record collection is a few people that I really, really love. And I have everything that they ever did.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and that's, I'd rather do it that way. I tend to get into these details. And so if I really like a song, I'll listen to it 1,000 times.
Yeah.
And so that will definitely get into my head. The weird part is that if I try to play it 15 years after the fact, for some reason, I remember it. And I don't
I'm jealous.
I don't really know why that is. A lot of the time, I can't find a verse up until the point when I have to sing it. I've run out of beats, you know, and I got to open my mouth and I get up to the microphone and suddenly the words come out. And as soon as the first word comes out, then everything else kind of comes with it.
Is that the same for chords as well? Like you can
a lot of the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, unless it's really weird and I've completely forgotten it, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, for some reason, and even strange things, we played Girl the other day. Beatles song, right?
Beatles,
and that's got a weird set of changes to it. It's got this, I think it's C-. Is there anybody going to listen to my story? All about the girl who came to stay. She's the kind of girl you want so much it makes you sorry. Still, you don't regret a single day. Oh, girl. Girl. You know?
Yeah.
And same thing. For some reason, it just all comes to my mind when it's there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, that's awesome.
I don't know why that is.
Well, it's a great trait to have.
It's a good one to play with, that's for sure. Yep. For doing gigs, it comes in real handy.
Yeah.
And it makes it fun, too, because if somebody requests something that I kind of remember, there's a good chance that I can get at least part of the way through it.
Yeah.
You know? Some of them, every now and then a song will throw a loop at you. Somebody requested Tiny Dancer once, you know? And I can't hit all the high notes that he did when he was a kid, but later on, he sings it a different way, and I can kind of do that. But there's a bit when it gets into that middle. So it's Blue Jean Baby, right?
Yeah.
He gets into that... All I feel is so real, lying there, no one near, only you, and you can't hear me. Now it's going to do something, and I'm going, oh, I don't remember where that goes.
Softly.
Softly. Yeah. And I think what it is, probably something like this.
Slow. I feel like
that. You know.
On the last
something
one.
Something like that. You know, so it'd be like a variation of a G or a G7.
Yeah.
Because it's going to then go down to the, hold me closer, tiny dancer.
Yeah. It's almost like a puzzle, I would assume. Like, you could kind of figure out a few of the chords and, yeah, like, okay, if I were him,
well, and sometimes
where would
this it just
go,
makes
right?
perfect sense that it's, yeah, going to go there.
Yeah, it's obvious.
You know, but sometimes, yeah, especially with piano players. Piano players, Billy Joel, Elton John, those kind of guys.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are voicings and things that they use that are pretty deceptive. You don't quite realize what's going on. Like, if you think of the band, had the song The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, right? So Dixie has this great, no, right?
Mm.
And it from there makes guitar sense. Virgil Kane is the name, and I served on the Dandel train till Stoneman's cavalry came, tore up the tracks again. You know what's going on there? So there's a C, but it has to have an E on the bottom of it, which is not a natural guitar move.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's
got to
have that,
right?
Then it's a C with a G on the bottom. So you get this kind of...
this weight to it, right?
You know,
yeah,
and it gives it a whole different rub. But a guitar player wouldn't really do that usually.
Yeah. Well, I think that's like, you know, guys like yourself, Mick Taggart, you know, these guitar players that are just like top notch. It's always like there's this common thread. You guys pay attention to the fucking details.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's about the details.
That's where the most fun part of it is.
Exactly.
Because you discover something, you know, Andrew and I lost our minds over Whole Lot of Love, right? If you think of Zeppelin's Whole Lot of Love, there's a trick. There's one little trick,
okay,
that if you've been playing the song for years and you do this trick, suddenly you go, holy shit, there it is.
Oh, you gotta, right, show me that.
What he does, everybody does this, right?
Yeah.
So it's three straight notes, right? That's not apparently what he does. He goes, there are two notes there. He's playing the open D string. And if I had distortion on and stuff, the dissonance between those two creates exactly that sound suddenly. And you just go, oh my God, there it is.
Right.
You know, and it blows your head apart as a guitar player. And I love it because Andrew gets just as excited about those stupid things as I do.
Yeah.
You know, I remember the two of us losing our minds over the solo to Old Brown Shoe. If you think of the Beatles, I want a love that's right, that is only half of what's wrong. I want a short-haired girl who sometimes wears it twice as long. I love that lyric. Now I'm stepping out of this old brown shoe. Baby, I'm in love with you. I'm so glad you came here. Won't be the same now that I'm with you.
Love,
right?
It.
So the solo starts on the F. Thank you. the last note, I think, is cut off by the tape. It might be something where they went, but it got in the way of the vocal. So they cut it really quick.
Yeah.
And the other guitar comes in underneath. You know.
Those little happy mistakes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's just the coolest solo. What a great solo.
So speaking of like great guitar players, like you were saying a second ago, working with Brian Griffith there, which I, you know, I see his,
it's his guitar right there.
That's
too.
His guitar right there. And, you know, he's obviously a legend, you know. What did you learn? And when you think back about, you know, Brian, you know, rest in peace. What did you learn from him?
Everything. There was a magazine that had a great article on Eric Clapton that I remember reading that was called The Artist Formerly Known as God. And it was really, really a funny way to put it. And the guy said, the interviewer said about Eric, I walked in there wanting to steal every one of his licks and, you know, just cop everything the guy ever did. I walked out of there thinking I'd rather cop his attitude because his attitude is so cool that it leads him to all of those places, right? What Brian was really about. That was the whole thing. He's a phenomenal guitar player. There's no question about that. I mean, we could talk endlessly about what he was capable of and his taste. And he did this thing where he used to harmonize with what the singer was singing and reharmonize chord passes as you were moving the melody. I mean, just unbelievable stuff. And to think that that was just coming right off the top of his head, you know,
just,
and, but his attitude towards music was so good. And his attitude towards musicians was so good. And his, you know, I remember, I think it was Tommy actually was telling me about A Night at the Cat and Fiddle. He was playing with Brian and he was really, really sick. He didn't feel, you know, and it started to get kind of worse and whatever. And he was kind of looking at Brian, you know, I'm not really feeling good. And Brian's response to that was, look, man, if you don't feel good, we'll call off the gig. We're done. You know, it's no problem at all. If you need to go, go. There's no pressure here. Mm. You know, he was completely on the side of the musician.
That's,
you know,
great.
Just 100% with you when you were on stage with him. And he was like that with everybody. You know, he was just, he was such a dude, man. He was such a fucking dude. It just the coolest character.
How did you guys connect?
So I had a girlfriend at the time who was crazy about a band called The Group. And she said, you got to come see these guys at Monaco's in Hess Village. So this is like
Monaco's.
What would it be? 95, 96, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
You know, early 96 probably. And the group was Harrison Kennedy, Brian Griffith, Steve Pelche, Bruno Ferrugia, and Scott Nielsen playing keyboard and sax.
Heavy.
And it was unbelievable how good it was, you know. And they'd play, they had this thing where they would improvise so much. And I did that with them as well. You know, you'd do a 45-minute set or a 50-minute set, and there would only be five songs. You know, you're just playing these marathons because once the place is dancing, you just keep them dancing.
Yeah.
You know, and then in the meantime, you're playing all this unbelievable stuff, drum solos, conga solos. Harrison was an amazing harmonica player, you know, and guitar solos, sax solos, whatever, bass solos. And everybody was just flying, you know. And Brian came up to me the one night, and the first thing he ever said to me was, what's up with you, man? You know, and scared the hell out of me because, you know, Brian, and he's standing, he's much taller than me anyway. Right?
Yeah.
And he's standing and I'm sitting. And of course, you know, kind of just terrified. He says, what's up with you, man? He says, every night I see you now. You and your girlfriend there, you're showing up all the time. And he says, everybody else is dancing. You're just sitting there looking at me the whole time. So you obviously play. And we got to talking, right? So we get talking away, and one night at a place called The Playground, which is long gone, they were playing. I was watching them, and he mentioned that he had this gig on Wednesdays at 33 Hess, and I should come out and bring a guitar and, you know, and I thought, great, it's like a jam night, you know, I'll come out. And well, I got there, it wasn't a jam night, it was a gig. It was him and Ray Taylor and Pete Riboney, and they played a set, and I walked in with my guitar and my amp, so there's no way I can walk out now, right?
You're in.
I'm in. So in the break, I get set up, and they said, okay, we're going to do a tune, and then you come up. I'm like, okay. So they did this tune and just blazed. Amazing, you know. And then as I was getting up on stage, shaking. I mean, physically shaking. My hands were shaking, right? As I was putting on my guitar, Brian was taking his off. And he went and grabbed a beer at the bar and sat at the very front table.
He button hooked you.
Looked at me for the whole fucking set. And I did like two songs. Maybe I only did one. But he made his point. You know,
yeah.
He certainly made his point. And my hands were shaking. So I had this other tune in mind. And I was just like, you know what? Let's keep it nice and simple. We'll play further on up the road. And, you know, hopefully I'll settle in. And I never really did. But it was lucky for me that I could sing in those days. Guys, nowhere near the kind of guitar playing that would interest somebody like that.
Yeah.
But I could sing, you know, so that was kind of the way in. Then he said, you know, why don't you come back next week? Knowing that he kind of, as you said, button hooked me. And the next week I went in with my guitar and he and I played together. And it was the first time we'd ever played together. And the first song that we played together was Take You There, right? I know a place. Ain't nobody crying, right? And Ray was amazing at singing that stuff, the drummer.
Yeah.
And it's only got two chords. So, okay, cool. And from there on, he said, you know, well, why don't you come back anytime? You know, because we got on really well. And I came back every Wednesday after that. And I just became part of the band. They weren't paying me, but it got to a point where I was sitting in all the time. So I would do a set with them. And then I would do the set, you know, if I do the second set, I'll do the third one too, you know. And then it was, I was just showing up with the rest of them. I just wasn't getting paid. Yeah. And then I made $10, I think, to bring a PA. Because I had a speaker and Ray didn't have shit. And so... And then that was my intro to it. And then I finally started becoming a member of the band. So it took about 6 months or 7 months or something.
Wow, man.
But
yeah, and Brian played with like, didn't he play with like Willie Nelson?
Sure
and
did.
Daniel Lanois and stuff. Like
he sure did.
Man.
The record is right there, actually. It's called Teatro.
Oh, you have it right here, huh?
That's it right there.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it's
so tell me about this. He played pretty much.
Well, Brian and Dan had been friends for a long time. And,
okay.
And Dan always really, he's so good at picking out these details in people's playing, little things. And it's like he has a notebook in his head where he just, oh, I got to remember that guy can do that, you know, and he'd known Brian for a long, long time and they'd worked together on a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
But he always knew he was such a great slide player. You know, Brian was an amazing slide player.
I know.
Right? So he had him playing slide on a lot of the record. And it was two drummers, and it was Willie and Emmylou Harris and Dan. And, you know, Bobby Nelson and that as well, Mickey Raphael. Just an amazing, amazing record. You know,
wow.
Really, really great record. And they do a lot of standard stuff. They do Où es-tu mon amour, which is a Django tune, I think.
See, and, I'd have to... sit down with that album and really listen to it too. Wow.
There's a tune on here called 3 Days that is your classic country songwriting.
Right? Okay.
It's I don't remember what key it's in, but it's like a... No, what would it be? 3 days I dread to be alive. 3 days I hate to see you arrive. 3 days filled with tears and sorrow. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Oh, come on. Love it, man. So good, man.
Yeah, he was great.
Yeah, man. Yeah, really, God really bless great. Him. I got to know Brian a little bit more in kind of last years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 2008, 2009, I think him and I started connecting, and he was always so kind to me, man.
Yeah.
Always so kind to me. And there was a moment there where I was starting to kind of just cover some popular music, put it out on YouTube and stuff. And he came in once and played with me, and it was so cool. So I got to play with him at least once, you know, which I'm so glad I did, but he couldn't have been a nicer soul, man. Like he really was.
And like I said, it gets to a point where I don't play anything like him. And the reason was because somewhere early on, I realized I'd rather cop his attitude.
I love that, man.
Than try to copy his playing.
Right.
Because really, what an just such a pure vision of what music is. Same as Andrew, Andrew's got that same thing where his love of music is so pure. It's so untainted after all the business shit that he's been through in his life, like anybody else his age.
But childlike spirit never went away. Towards music, right?
It never went away. It burns just as hot now as it did when he was a teenager.
Absolutely.
And that can't be said for a lot of people.
Andrew's to the point, like I was talking with him, he has his little ukulele where if he's in traffic, he will grab his ukulele. And you do it. you guys are two in the same, man. And I love when I watch the both of you guys play together because I get to hear guitar harmonies.
Because
you guys figure out, okay, where can we, it's always fun, but I just love to hear it because the two of you guys can really feed off one another, which is great.
Because we both get such a giggle out of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's so much fun.
You can nerd out a little
bit. You really
can,
right? Because he's so accepting of it. I remember there's a Petty tune called American Girl. And we started playing that with a band that we did called Airbag, which was Shime, Andrew, me, and Nick Chynogorski.
Okay.
Out in Toronto at the Underground. And it was such an awesome gig. I really missed that place. And amazing dude running the sound. His name's Noel Copeman. And he was such a happy, friendly, fun guy to work with. And we started doing that tune. And there's a bit in it when it breaks down where it goes... And there's a little guitar tag that goes, right? And if you don't play it, it's not the same. It's like.
You need it.
Right? So, of course, we did it. And then we both hit it at the same time. And then looking at each other, laughing. The second time through it, of course, he plays. And you get.
Right.
And oh man, we just something those so are, stupid. Nobody else would care, but they'd look at us.
Those
and go,
are the moments,
nerds.
Right? You see it a lot, right? Like, fellow musicians might pick up on it, but you're watching that show and that interaction within the band when you really love the guys that you're playing with, too, right? Those moments. And I love it, like I did a show with Andrew and Susie last weekend. And for me, I'm a vocalist, I love harmony, mm-hmm. So there's moments where we're doing some of these songs for the first time, no rehearsal. And all of a sudden a three part just nailed. And you kind of look at each other, it's similar with you, myself and Susie. We did it last summer mm-hmm. together. And there's those moments where we sort of look at each other where no one else knows. They just think it's kind of a day in the office. But for us, it's the first time we've actually done this song together. And when those vocals are locked in,
that's it.
Or when that guitar part's locked in, and it just, those are the moments that you love and that you geek out about after the gig.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know? That's what you remember the gig for, because at our age, you played so many of them.
Yeah, exactly.
That you can't possibly remember every gig, but you do remember those moments.
Moments. Yeah.
You do remember those silly little things. And Tommy and I have a whole bunch of things like that, because Tommy and I have always worked really well together, but we have very, very different ways of working.
Yeah.
It's completely different. He and I are so different in so many ways, but there's something really common about the way we work together, the way we sing together, the way we play together. It just sort of makes sense
totally.
To us,
Yeah.
And it was particularly in the singing. And it was the same thing. When we first started singing together, when we were on our way to Los Angeles, and we were singing in the car a lot, and the three of us would be singing, but Andrew wasn't the most confident singer at that point. So he'd be in the back. He had a mandolin that he always used to bring with him. And Tommy and I just be singing away for 8 hours or 9 hours. It's no wonder we both blew our voices to shit, but it just worked that way. And there were those little things that would happen and go, fuck, man, we got to get that on tape. We've got to do something about that.
Yeah. Tell me about that time, man, because you, Andrew, and Tommy all moved to LA together, mm-hmm. And especially on the height when, Tommy got shot out of a cannon there. And the three of you guys were out in LA for several months. Mm-hmm. That must have been
almost a year.
Yeah. It must have been a wild time, right?
It started in the most insane way that it could, is the thing. So we had Tommy's Jeep, which was a really nice Jeep.
I remember that Jeep.
That was a really good, chromed out, beautiful Jeep. And I drove stick, Andrew didn't. So it would be either me or Tommy driving, right? And it was almost always him, because he loves to drive.
Yeah.
He's all about it, right? So, but the first thing, very first thing that happened was we got in this huge border lineup in Detroit. So we had a U-Haul trailer on the back that was completely stacked with guitars and amps and some clothing, you know what I mean? But really, it was kind of like gym bags and a suitcase and then just reams of gear, yeah. You know? And so anyway, we got in line in Detroit. And then they pulled us into the little room because they wanted to search the vehicle and all this kind of thing. And they were very threatening and very hostile towards us. Andrew put his hands in his pockets and this little guy was screaming at him, you know. And they found, they have this spray that they spray on the carpets and things, like a litmus test. And if it turns whatever color, there's evidence of whatever that is, right? So it was weed in our case. We were no. pot smokers at the time, you know. What's that? What's that Mitch Hedberg joke? I used to do drugs. I still do, but I used to too.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we got that. But there was nobody had anything on him. We're not stupid. We're not. Of course. Just should have. You know, we should have vacuumed the Jeep before we left. But they had us there for, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours, something.
Did you
like
have
that.
Visas?
We did. We had the whole thing sorted out. Letter from his record company and everything else. It's just they wanted to make sure that we were not actually trying to bring drugs in, right?
Sure.
Which of course we weren't. So eventually they let us through. We then drove straight to Nashville. So we got to Nashville at like 10:30 in the morning. We drove all through the night and we were all so revved up, you know. We slept for a couple of hours, got out of there at around probably 3 o'clock, 3:30, and went straight to a bar. And that began the trip, right? So that night things happened like, well, Andrew and I both got kicked out of, what was it called? Stage, I think.
Oh, the Stage is still there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We got kicked out of there because we were way too drunk. Tommy disappeared completely.
To get kicked out of a bar in Nashville, you got to be pretty hammered.
We were pretty hammered. Sloppy, you know. And then I bought a cowboy hat too, I think.
As you do.
As you do.
Right.
And drunkenly paraded that around like an idiot, you know. yeah, it was just, it was a crazy, the whole thing was crazy. And the road trip had everything from, you know, wild, drunk and nice, like in Memphis, you know, we were getting our... yeah. Getting into our cups that night too. And then stuff like we took a helicopter through the Grand Canyon and we went to Silver City in New Mexico where Billy the Kid was born allegedly, you know, and I almost got shot because I was talking to somebody I probably shouldn't have been, but he was the nicest fella. In my defense, I was pretty drunk at the time, but he was a dude. It's just that I should have read the signs a little bit, you know? So it was a Mexican guy. His name was Angel, right?
Oh, tattoos, there's your first sign.
Yeah, right, tattoos there. Up the side of his neck, you know, and this kind of thing. And he was just a dude. And we were laughing at each other, comparing slang, because his Mexican accent and my Canadian accent, right?
Yeah.
So when you say motherfucker, and he'd laugh his ass off, and it's not how you say it, you know? You say it like this, and he would say it his way, right? And
put
emphasis on a different syllable and all this. We thought it was hilarious, you know? And he was just as drunk as I was. Somebody else who had nothing to do with the conversation was going to their car because they thought I was making fun of the States and, you know, laughing at the whole thing. And they take that shit pretty serious down there.
Yeah.
You know, and he was going to his car to get a gun to come back and, you know, have me on.
What?
This guy, Casey, I'm not making this up. This guy, Casey, who was absolutely hilarious, crazy guy. Casey and his buddies were there as well. Casey comes up to me at one point and goes, "Whatever happens, we got your back." And I had no idea what that meant. I thought, well, that's friendly. Thanks very much, you know. And so apparently these guys went over, found this guy, you know, dragged him to the ground or whatever, disarmed him and got him the fuck out of there. I never knew any of it. Tommy told me about it at like 5 or 6 in the morning, you know, that he thought I was going to get killed.
What
and all this.
Hell,
and I had no idea, completely oblivious to the whole thing, you know. And it turns out that Casey and his buddies were home from, I think it was Afghanistan at the time. They were all U.S. military guys.
So they were picking up on the signs.
They were fine. You know, one guy with a gun. Yeah, no problem. you know.
Jesus Christ.
And yeah, and I had no idea about any of it. I wrote a song called California Singer, and in it is a line that says, say what you want to Casey, but he got me out alive, you know.
Really?
And it's literally true, yeah.
Man, so yeah. That's on your way to LA.
That's on the way. That was like day six or something like that. And then we hightailed it out of Silver City, I can tell you. And
that's a movie scene.
Yeah. And then drove straight into this insane storm going out of Highway 180, listening to Johnny Cash sing, when the man comes around, hear the pipers, hear the drummers, 100 million angels singing, right? And we're driving up
into a fucking
these fucking cliff roads going into the hills where you've got a lane either way, making a blind turn, and there's a gravel shoulder with no guardrail that then drops about 300 feet straight down onto rock, you know. And, you know, it's pouring rain and everything else. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
It was a crazy, crazy trip.
Yeah.
You know, and then, like I say, after that was Arizona. We went to Grand Canyon, camped out there for a little bit, drove through the Mojave Desert to get to LA.
Yeah.
And were greeted in Los Angeles by the worst traffic I've ever seen in my entire life. And, you know, ended up going down to Redondo Beach. About 3 weeks later, we had a house. And that was it. We stayed there for quite a long time after that.
Yeah.
Surfing and recording. And
did you dig the LA scene or?
I like the beach for the water because I like surfing. That was really fun.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like the LA scene particularly.
Yeah.
There are things about Los Angeles that the weather's amazing.
Sure.
You know, and there are a lot of great people there and a lot of excitement, a lot of artists and things like that. But for me, I think the weather is a bit of a thing. You know, I don't like it when it's sunny all the time. I actually like it when it's wintertime in Los Angeles and starts to rain. And
I'm totally with you, man. I think the change of seasons are good for you.
I think so too.
You know,
I found it a bit much, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I came home for Christmas and I was surfing the day before, you know, and the water's cold, but it wasn't
terrible. Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it was stuff like that. LA, of course, is really, really spread out. So
yes.
A lot of driving, a lot of traffic, a lot of that kind of thing, which I don't like at all.
No, same.
So there were ups and downs about it. Generally speaking, I thought it was great.
Yeah.
You know, I really had a lot of fun. We were outside of Los Angeles, though. We were like in Hermosa Beach.
Yeah. And I think when you're that age and you're sort of exploring the world, like, I think that's important.
Yeah.
You know, you get it at least outside of your mind. Like, I've experienced that now, too, like moving away from home a couple times. And, you know, that realizing how much home really means to me.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think you got to get out there, get some experience, you know, for good or for bad, whatever. But you're not going to know until you just get out there.
You got to try these things. I'm not a huge fan of cities, but I love New York. You know?
I love New York.
And it's that kind of thing.
Chicago.
Yeah.
I love.
Yeah. I like places that have a real identity like that. It's really cool. The only time I've ever been to Europe, for example, we went to Italy. And that was extraordinary. And we did that, the train pass, right? So you pay for like 5 or 6 days of travel and you can just go wherever the hell you want.
Yeah.
So we landed in Rome, went down to Naples, Capri and all of that, and went up to Florence, to Venice, flew out of Milan.
That's
so
awesome.
You get a real taste of what's going on in that country. And it was magic, absolute magic. Certain things where you go, this is just so civilized. You know, the idea of a siesta is so civilized.
I love it.
You know, where you work early in the morning to the afternoon, then you bugger off for a few hours and then you open up and you go late. You know, I think that's great.
Yeah.
You know, you get the best part of the day with the family or with whoever, you know, go for a coffee. They take certain things really, really seriously. Baking, you know, food, coffee itself, you know, and I love that. You take something like that seriously. Everywhere you go, there's great coffee.
I know.
You know, I didn't have one bad coffee the whole time I was there. Oh, magic. Just magic.
I mean, I had almost the identical trip to you. Mm-hmm. So one of the only places I went to in Europe has been Italy. And it was almost identical. I went to Rome. I went to Naples, to Positano, Florence for a day. Didn't get to Venice.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to check that out. But it was, I mean, the culture, the history, it's fantastic. But you kind of need like a vacation away from the vacation.
You do,
moments
like
that, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
You know, walking for 13, 14 hours a day because you just can't stop. you know.
Yeah, and I did it in like August, fucking just melting. I was like,
we went in December and it was still hot.
Yeah, see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was still like 20, 25, 26 degrees.
Yeah. You know, one thing I wanted to talk to you about is poor Angus, because, you know, you're brought up with some of the that old school music, Nirvana, mm-hmm. all this stuff. And then you join this really cool Celtic folk group. Was that some of the influences that you heard as well when you were growing up?
I think I wasn't really terribly into it at the time.
Yeah.
When I first met those guys, they were coming to see me at Gallagher's, I think. And I was playing there. And they kept asking me about it, you know, would I want to do this and would I be interested? And I kept going, no, not really. You know, I mean, you guys are nice and everything, but it's not really my kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to hear certain songs, you know, and I started to notice that there was a really distinct similarity in a lot of what was going on in Irish music, English music, Scottish music. There's something in there that's really very reminiscent of American music. When you talk about the blues and when you talk about early country music and things like that, there's something very similar to the general feel of what's coming out. You know, they're really honest with what they're talking about.
Yeah.
They're really sincere and they really did go after a kind of playing. When you listen to some of the early blues guys, you listen to Robert Johnson or you listen to Blind Willie McTell, Charlie Patton, you know, some of those guys are really, really interesting guitar players. Mississippi John Hurt, Scrapper Blackwell I've got a couple of his records here too. That dude is a really cool guitar player. And it's really interesting stuff. And then you start to hear these similarities of, you know, sort of blue notes, except they're coming out in something that's Irish and 150 years old, you know. And you start to dig the whole history of it, because there's a whole thing that goes around it. You know, Ireland's not been the most peaceful place in the last 100 years.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of writing that's been done about that. And a lot of really great shit has come out because of that.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you start to kind of find it. And then I started trying to play it. And it's insane, some of it. Some of those reels and jigs and things like that, they're really, really fucking hard to play, man. There was the first one that really stymied me was a tune called Big Jigs that they do. That's a set of three different songs, but it starts like this. And then there are changes in it. That is the weirdest rhythm to try to wrap your head around, because it reverses itself, right? So if you tried to do this up and down all the way through it, you'd get, and now it's reversed. You're starting with an upstroke and then it goes back, up, down.
Yeah.
It's really confusing. So there's a double little that you put in there. But to try to get that up to tempo.
Yeah. And sing to it.
Yeah. And some of those things were really complicated. Yeah.
And that's the thing, keeping that tempo.
Yeah.
Because fuck, man, like after doing a, you know, a few tunes like that, like the fatigue.
Yeah. You really do. Right? If we're doing a full show, we do two sets that are about an hour and 10 each, hour and 15 each.
Yeah.
And that break in the middle is absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely necessary. Everybody comes back going, oh, okay, here we go.
Yeah. Right.
Shaking out your hands and. It's really tricky stuff to play. And the idea is that it revs you up. And then when you do these ballads and things, some of them are absolutely amazing. The lyrics that go into them and the thought, the sincerity that goes into some of these things. And again, you know, you and I were talking about harmonies before. Amazing harmonies.
A lot of the acapella stuff that you guys would do, just the wall of voices that I love.
Yeah, Sam Hall and there's a great one called Jack Ashton too that DJ sings that I really, really like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So you just kind of learn to love it through the things you related to already then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I started to find the connection, that was the real secret to it all, that there was a connection between this music and what I had grown up listening to.
Isn't that
to.
One of the best ways to learn?
I think so.
As well, as far as like, how do I attach this to something that I already know and find those similarities, right? And that I find that's how I can make sense of things, just finding the patterns that relate.
Yeah.
Not so much what's so different about folk, what's so different about blues, what's so, you know, what are those common threads that connect it all?
Yeah. Well, music has a way of stripping away all the bullshit. Mm-hmm. Not the music business. I'm talking about the actual music. The music business does nothing but pile bullshit on top. The music itself tends to really strip away a lot of shit. And what you're doing is you're listening to a person. You're listening to a human being. And some guys really find that. Mm. They find a way to be themselves, you know, and that's why we love them so much. Yeah. Guys, a guy like Willie Nelson, there's only one Willie Nelson. You know, Tom Waits is another one where, you know, God love him, when he's dead, there won't be another one of those.
Yeah.
Freddie Mercury was the same thing.
Bob Dylan.
You know, Bob Dylan is another one, right? And even Dylan doesn't know where he got that early stuff. He did an interview on 60 Minutes where he was talking about that. And he says, it's just something comes out, you know, when you're a kid and all of this energy and everything else. And he says a lot of it was just written to write. And out came Blowing in the Wind.
Yeah.
And out came Times Era Changing and whatever.
When I think about Bob and, you know, when he picked up an electric guitar and people are fucking screaming Judas.
Oh, yeah.
To him, it's like man, these people are invested here.
Absolutely.
You know, and he's like, I'm just playing some music and telling some stories. But when you think about, like, literally calling this guy Judas for picking up an electric.
It's something where you know, now we look back on it from our perspective. And you go, you people are out of your fucking minds.
Right.
You got Bob Dylan and the band on stage and you're booing them.
Right.
Are you out of your mind? What are you doing? There's a record I've got called Before the Flood that you should really get.
Okay.
It's a double album with Bob Dylan and the band. And it's unbelievable. The energy in it is so good. And you just go, how could you ever not like this? But you're right. They were so invested in come gather round people wherever you roam. And Mr. Tambourine Man and all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
You know, and when you think about that stuff, again, that individuality, right? Because there have been all kinds of poets in songwriting, and certainly guys like Woody Guthrie and where Bob was coming from, you know, Pete Seeger and these kind of people. But nobody did what he did, you know, where there was a joy in just playing with words. You know, John Lennon had that too.
Yeah.
A joy in just fucking around with words for the sake of doing it. Have you ever read John's book?
I haven't.
A Spaniard in the Works?
No.
So he had a couple of books, one called In His Own Right, and the really good one is called A Spaniard in the Works. And actually, it's on the top shelf over there.
But I could geek out in your basement for hours here, man. You have so much cool stuff.
Well, that's a hilarious book. It starts with a story called A Spaniard in the Works. That the opening line is, Jesus El Pifco was a foreigner, and he knew it. You know?
Huh?
And you go, what?
Right.
The fuck does that mean? He started goofing around with the words themselves. So
well, look at like come together.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
That's a perfect example.
It starts with a Chuck Berry line. Here come old flat top, come grooving up slowly. Except in Chuck's world, it was, here come old flat top, he come grooving up slowly, you know?
Yeah.
And that wasn't the first time they had done that either. John had a tune called Run for Your Life, right? I don't remember what key it's in. Well, I'd rather see a dead little girl than to be with another man is Elvis. Elvis has Let's Play House, right? And it's, what key is it in? Come back, baby, I won't play house with you. Right? Well, listen to me, baby, try to understand. I'd rather see a dead little girl than to be with another man. Well, baby, come back, baby, come. And that's where he got it from.
And it's interesting that they could, like, now so many people are precious about publishing and stuff that, you know, they're literally just taking lines from other songs and no one's, you know, up in arms about it.
Nope.
You used to see that a ton back in the day of just paying homage to songs that were out maybe a year before. It didn't even have to be an old tune.
Yeah.
It's just, okay, Rolling Stones are covering this tune or that band's covering that. And it was just the Beach Boys, for example, you know, things like that. Which, by the way, your dad fucking opened up for the Beach Boys?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
That's
They played at the Toronto Rock and Roll Revival too.
Maple Leaf Gardens, right? Lennon. Your old man played Maple Leaf Gardens.
Sure did.
Sorry, I just remembered that. That's so cool, man.
Yeah, they were cool. They were really, really cool. They still are cool.
Yeah, yes. But these people would pay homage to these bands, right? And I don't know. Maybe it's become more business than music, you know, as we've gone along and gone through some decades. But I love that because there's just this togetherness with the artist, which I think is amazing, man. And I'd love to see a little bit more of that, you know, because I really believe there's a strength in numbers in that.
Well, without getting too historical, philosophical about it, there was a huge change that happened when the internet came about. And one of the really, really shitty things that happened was to the musicians themselves. They had to find themselves in a position of being businessmen themselves. And you didn't have the luxury of just playing music. You had to have some idea what the hell was going on in the business, because chances are you're going to be representing yourself in a lot of this shit. You know, when suddenly there was no money in the record industry overnight, you know, musicians really suddenly had to fend for themselves. And a lot of independent shit was going on. But in one way, it was a total nightmare, because it meant that musicians had to stop making musical decisions for musical reasons, you know, and you started having to compromise and you started having to do all that kind of thing. And it just puts you in a different place, puts you in a different headspace. And it just doesn't work the same way. And musicians started getting more and more competitive with one another rather than working with one another. You know, when you look back, especially in the '60s, when it was all that hippie madness, you know, places like Laurel Canyon, where you just had everybody. They were just all there, you know, everybody from Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and the Byrds and the Beach Boys. And, you know, it was just insane what was going on down there, you know, and you do find that England in the '60s was the same. London was the same, where you had the Stones, the Beatles,
British Invasion.
You had everything that came with that, right? The Yardbirds and Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, all of these guys making records right now and down the street from one another, you know, and then
I
you
guess
get,
lastly was Seattle, right?
And the Who. You know, and the Seattle thing was the same thing, where you sort of go, where is all this coming from? But it just happens every now and then, where a pocket of stuff, you know, and the reason that you're not seeing that as much anymore is because it doesn't really matter where you are anymore.
Yeah.
You know, the box will take you anywhere you want to go.
I know.
You can record live with somebody in Australia if you want to, you know, but in one hand, it takes the preciousness out of it. You know, you don't get to be Paul McCartney without caring a great deal about being Paul McCartney. Do you know what I mean? It's an obsession. Lennon said that in one of the interviews. Don't you think the Beatles gave everything they had to be the Beatles?
Right.
You know, it wasn't an accident, you know.
In 7 years.
Yeah. Yeah. They went for it like lunatics, and they worked like lunatics. And you want to know why they're great songwriters? Because they fucking wrote all the time.
Exactly.
You know, and just hundreds and hundreds of songs that these guys came out with, and they just got better and better and better. And you listen to the early efforts at stuff like Please Please Me, and you go, yeah, I can see where this is going to go, you know. And then in just a year, you know, and Hard Day's Night comes out, and then Help comes out, and then fucking Rubber Soul and Revolver, and then and you just go, what?
It's insane.
What are you guys doing over there? Two records a year at times.
Crazy.
The Beatles really only went from like 63 to 70, you know? So you got 7 years there and what, 16 albums or 15 albums or something like that?
It's insane.
You know, it's mental what they did. And in that collection of records is Sgt. Pepper, which if you only did that in your whole life,
it's a
you'd
mic
still
drop.
Be a fucking legend.
Right.
You know, and it was his, according to his interview with Rick Rubin, Paul says it was an answer to Pet Sounds.
Exactly.
You know, that he really liked that. And he thought, well, we got to do something better than that then. So we did Sgt. Pepper. It's like, you son of a bitch.
Right.
Where the fuck, you know.
It's crazy.
But that's the thing. You care that much to be that good. And our heroes always are. Tom Petty is one of those guys, you know, where he cared that much to be that guy. You know, and you get those songs and you get those performances, and Petty is just, he's the same. I put him in the same world as any of those guys, because he hung out with all of those guys too. They accepted him as well.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got Ringo and George Harrison on a record with you, you know,
you're doing something,
you're
right.
You're doing fine.
Yeah. You know, like I said in the beginning of the pod here, looking at your vinyl, I think that's another reason why, you know, I really want to dive into getting into the vinyl as well, is because of that connection, connection with that grabbing the vinyl, putting it, hearing the needle hit, really trying to, it almost can feel like a time machine.
It is,
you know, and you could sit back and get into that headspace. And I think for songwriters and musicians like us, what a great way to connect, where I think the convenience of what we do, and I'm guilty for it. I do it, Spotify, Apple Music, but I feel like there's a bit of a disconnection. Here's just another song. Here's just another playlist.
Right. Because it's disposable.
Exactly.
Because there are so many songs that even if you hear a great one, it's just in with the mix of whatever.
Yeah.
The thing is, music is all about connection. That's the whole point of it in the first place.
Exactly.
Brian and I used to talk about this all the time. There's only one music, the same way that there's only one people, you know, and in all of these different forms, people from China, people from, you know, Vietnam, people from Japan, all completely different human beings. And then all you have to do is go a couple of hours one way and you're in a completely different world.
Right.
You know, and you go from Japan to Australia, you go from Australia, God knows where, the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, you know, get yourself into Spain, get yourself into Amsterdam, England, you know, get into South America, get into Central America. You've got just such diverse human beings.
And you can learn so much the culture.
And consequently, you have such diverse music. But the fact is, if you get down to it, we're all talking about the same shit. We're all talking about peace and love and war and happiness and I lost my girl. You know, there are songs that are hundreds of years old about breaking up with a girl.
Yeah.
You know, it never goes away. There's just something about being a human being.
Yeah.
And music is the direct line to that. For some reason, it plugs directly into what you are somehow. It just cuts out everything else. And if it hits you at the right spot, hits you at the right time, at the right age, with the right song, it absolutely flattens you for the rest of your life. And that song will go with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And you can get into artists. Noel Gallagher made a great point about the world that we're in. And a lot of it is because Spotify and that kind of stuff. And he said, what happens is we live in a time where people will go into a coffee shop and spend a tenner on two cups of bad coffee, you know, and talk about nothing and sit with their cell phones and spend half the time not even talking to one another, you know, for 45 minutes and then fuck off. And they'll get physically angry with you if you suggest that they spend that 10 bucks on a record that might change the way you think, change the way you live, change the way you wear your hair or the way you dress or a kind of genre of music that you've never really scoped out before, you know? And that's where we are. It's become a very, very disposable thing. And so I do tend to cling to the guys that I love, you know, and I do cling to the records and things like that because I don't want to see that stuff go away.
No.
For me, there's something about it. And like I say, it's the connection. And you can get into the amount of sound and how they sound and all of that kind of thing. You can get great digital sound. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
You know, but there is a particular thing that happens with analog sound. And we've all experienced it, you know, call it what you will. But it is that connection. It's the purest form of that connection to me. You know, it might not be for everybody else, but for me, that's the way it is. I love having the thing in my hand. I love putting it on. I love on older records when they've been played a lot, they start to crackle a little bit, you know, and brand new records are sharp as hell. A lot of the remasters that they're coming out with, unbelievable stuff.
Right.
You know, the Stones did great remasters. Oasis did great remasters. You know, a lot of that stuff is just so kick-ass when you listen to it because their emphasis is on different stuff. I'll tell you the coolest one, that Beatles stereo box set right there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that was a primary concern was to turn up the bass in the recordings. So they crank up the bass and the bass drum. And suddenly you hear Paul and Ringo going at it in a way that you never really got on before, you know, and it's fucking brilliant.
That's it, man.
Absolutely brilliant.
Energy's in the details.
It
man.
Is. And it's just, it's so, so important to me that musicians experience that and get into it because otherwise I think your experience in it is fairly shallow, especially if you're living in a time where you're forced to concentrate on the business, you know? And there's a guy again, where a guy like McTaggart is somebody that everybody should meet, you know?
Right.
Because he would teach you a thing or two about just listen to it. Just have fun.
Yeah.
Listen to the goddamn thing. Crank it up and go for a bike ride, you know?
That's it.
I mean, how much more childish can it be? Go out with your Walkman and take a bike ride. But it's fucking fun. And that's why he does it.
It's the best, man. It's the best. He, every like maybe once every couple of weeks, I don't know if he does this with you still, but if he's listening to something that he really loves, he'll just send it. So you were talking about Bob Dylan and the band. So a couple of weeks ago, he was all about I Shall Be Released.
Oh,
right. And he's like, man, just listen to what the Keys are doing. Listen to what, the, you know, and I, you know, that's the thing, man. When you really break down these songs and you realize, okay, that's really what makes it great.
Yeah.
You know, or all these little pieces and parts coming together, you know, and it's, you know, Tommy said it too, man. He said it on the pod. It's about capturing a moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing with the vinyl. When you're listening to these old albums and some new, you're hearing these moments that were just captured. Like you said a second ago with Elvis Presley, 42 takes.
That's right.
But there was a moment within one of those 42 takes that has lived forever.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. And I just love that.
There's a great one, a collection of Beatles outtakes that I'm dying to get my hands on, but I've heard a bunch of it. And there's one, there's a song of theirs on one of the early records. I forget which one. Called Mr. Moonlight. And it starts with this amazing scream, right? And I can't do it full volume, but if I go back here, it's sort of Mr. Moonlight. And then the song kicks in, right? Well, in the outtakes, John does that scream and goes, Moonlight. Okay, let me do that again. And you hear Paul in the background go, really? It, like, that was amazing, dude. Yeah. You want to start that again? Okay, fine. But wow. All right.
Yeah. And you feel like you're in the room. Man. Yeah. You feel like you're in the room. I love it, man. I could honestly talk to you all day about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, this is great fun, man.
But I'll wrap it up with this. Every episode that I do, I ask a couple rapid questions to end it off.
Yeah, go on then.
So actually, this is a great segue. First one is, you're adding one Beatle to your new garage band. Which Beatle are you adding and why?
George.
You're adding George.
George, yeah. Because I love John Lennon. I absolutely love him. He's right there. You know?
He's a dude.
And the four of them are over there. And yeah, I love John. I have a feeling that if I was working with John personality-wise, I would just be making a John Lennon record. I would be following him, you know, and the same thing with Paul. I would be so intimidated. But the thing about George is that George is not as intimidating, and not because he's not as good. He's every bit as good a songwriter, an amazing guitar player. You know, it had nothing to do with talent. It was something about the choices that he made in songs where I feel like I could have gotten in there with him, you know, and maybe kind of gone with him on a few things.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously Ringo would be great to work with in anything.
Sure.
Because you know? Ringo's just Ringo. He's just such a dude.
He's such a dude.
But yeah, I would say George, just because I feel like we could actually, I would not be as intimidated, I suppose, is what it would be.
Okay. Dream guitar.
Dream guitar?
I mean, you probably got a fucking grocery list.
I have one of them.
Okay, what's that?
Which is a 69 Les Paul with a 68 neck that
does that
has
come
a
out
very
often,
colorful story. Yeah, it was a gold top. I played that exclusively. It's that one right there, the black one.
Oh, okay.
I played that exclusively for probably 10 years. And I got that from Bill Dylan. It was his wife's guitar, Barb's guitar, but it was too big and too clunky and too heavy because, you know, for Les Pauls, they weigh a ton.
Yeah.
And Barb's not huge, right? And so he sold it to me and it's absolutely amazing. That's one. My dream guitar of any guitars that I don't have would be, there'd be two of them. One would be a practical one. And the practical one would be like a 60s ES355 with a stereo jack and a Bigsby on it. And that would be an amazing guitar. The Veritone switch, right? That'd be an amazing guitar. And the other one would be George's Ricky 12 string.
Ricky.
The Fire Glow. Yeah. That's just such an amazing guitar.
Yeah.
But I've never seen one left-handed, so I don't hold out much hope.
That's the thing. You are left-handed. Here's one. You can teleport to any time in history. Where are you going?
That's almost impossible. It would kind of depend on how I felt on the day. You know, musically,
we'll keep it music. Why not?
Fuck, musically, I would love to go back to about 1967 in England, because it was like a guitar player's summit that happened in London, where you had George Harrison, you had Eric Clapton, you had Jeff Beck, you had Jimmy Page, you had Pete Townsend, you had all these amazing guitar players. And in 67, suddenly Jimi Hendrix, who was in England more than any of the You know, when he came back to the States, the Americans thought he was English because he'd been in England for a little while. But that was kind of where it happened. And so there are these great stories about Hendrix playing a club and asking if Eric is in the audience because he needs him to tune his guitar, you know. It would be so fucking unbelievable to see that going
Just sit in that room. Really.
Yeah, to be in a place and go, okay, well, the Rolling Stones are on one corner of the room and the fucking Beatles are on the other, because that happened.
That's crazy. You know,
there were times when those guys were all in the same room and you know, whether they actually got to know each other or anything like that. I'm sure they did to a degree. But Jesus Christ.
Just to be a fly on the wall.
Just to be there to witness all of that. You know, it's some of the most influential music that's ever been made. Yeah. And in about 67, you had the real hippie thing coming on. So Sgt. Pepper and the psychedelic stuff was really coming about.
Yeah.
And I think it just would have been an extraordinary thing to see,
yeah,
you know, just this explosion, this free explosion of just the most amazing music.
Awesome. Road story. You told me a great one with the New Mexico, but is there any other road stories? I mean, you toured with Tommy, you did some stuff with Poor Angus. I'm sure some interesting stuff has, has happened.
Yeah, no question about that. I remember little things from time to time. Brian LeBlanc in Poor Angus, we were trying to find our way into this one festival and we were having a hell of a time doing it. And he picked up a police barrier and just moved it and drove his truck through it and went to put the police barrier back. And of course, a cop comes over and the cop goes, "What is it exactly that you think you're doing?" You know, like looking at him going, "All right, let's get into this."
Yeah.
You know, I remember that. That was pretty funny. The stuff with Tommy and Andrew was insane. I could tell stories about being in Hollywood with Swick. Holy God. The worst, I'll tell you the worst thing that can happen in those days, because Tommy's not really like this anymore.
No, no.
You know, I know. And for good reason. But the worst thing that could happen is we'd be out. And at the time in LA, it was usually the four of us, right? It was Mike, Shime, and Andrew, me and Tommy. And all of a sudden, you know, Andrew and I'd be talking about guitars and Mike had come back from the bar and the three of us would be sitting at the table for an uncomfortably long amount of time before somebody went, "Where's Tommy?"
Uh-oh.
And, oh shit, where is Tommy? And you start wandering. You go, you know, the Viper Room and the Key Club and all these places trying to figure out where the fucking guy is. That those days, that was quite a thing.
Yeah.
Because he would just get blitzed and wander, you know. I did that a couple of times too, where I just kind of, I'd get a little too into it. And I'd have to just leave, get some fresh air and walk up down the street and the same things. Where the fuck were you?
Well,
you can't just leave.
He told me on the pod, he told me about sleeping on the wrong tour bus.
Yeah. Well, that's a legendary story.
Yes. Yeah,
did he tell you that Ed told that from Bare Naked Ladies?
He did mention that Ed from Bare Naked Ladies.
Ed's fucking road Strombo, story. Right? Yeah. His road story was actually Tommy's story, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny some of the stuff that happens. I tend to remember really pleasant stuff though, rather than crazy things or reckless things or fights, people getting bottled, you know, stuff like that. I remember being on stage one time with a blues band and somebody chucked a beer bottle up on stage and hit a guy right in the mouth, you know, and knocked out a couple of his teeth. I remember that. I remember a cab driver getting bottled too at a gig. I don't know. I suppose I don't really choose it, really. That's the wrong word. But I like thinking about the really fun stuff that happened at the gigs. You know, I like thinking about moments when the band really just takes off and it's a whole different thing. Keith Richards says it's like floating. You start to leave the ground, you know, and I remember quite a few of those times. 33 has had some great times for that, playing with Brian and Jesse.
It's all about the music, right?
Man. Yeah.
That's what I love. Is. That's what I love about you, man. You've always cut the bullshit and it has always been about the music and about the moment when you're creating music.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what it's all about.
There are two things in writing music and playing music with other people that I absolutely can't stand. And it annoys me in a way that's like George Carlin said, it's not a pet peeve. It's a psychotic fucking hatred.
Okay.
You know, and one of them is when people try to learn the song while you're playing it. That drives me crazy. You know, when you're just trying to get somebody to listen to a song and they're noodling over top of it or not really, you know, and you kind of go, "Oh man, you're not really even listening to it. Why am I even playing this? You know, it's not just a set of chords, you know, I'm trying to get a point across here." That annoys me. And the other thing that really, really annoys me when it comes to, when it comes to working with other people is people that make decisions for the wrong reasons. If the song is better, but it comes out 10 seconds longer or 15 seconds longer and it doesn't quite fit into radio single length, and so we're going to have to trim it down because that's the way it is. Yeah. I go, yeah, but is the song better or not? You know, if the song is better, then that thing should stay, that 10 seconds should fucking be there.
I know.
You know, and that I do get really up in arms about things like that.
It's not about the song at that point.
That's it. There are great songs that are singles that are five. Look at Pink Floyd, for Christ's sake. You know, they had singles that were 5 and 6 minutes long, like a Rolling Stone.
Right.
One of the most influential songs of all time is not a single length song. It's like 5 minutes long. You know, Bohemian Rhapsody. All of these things, I don't think you can get great if you're following all the bullshit that they're telling you to do.
Yeah.
You know, because it's too much shit in your head. You got to just get rid of it and play the goddamn song. And that's when I really get excited that's one of the reasons I love working with Tommy. Tommy's really, really spontaneous and he gets these ideas for songs that just come out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. I watched him one time when we were living together. He went into the bathroom. I was recording. He went into the bathroom, took a shower and came out with a verse and a chorus. And had a towel wrapped around himself and stood there and said to me, is this a song? And started singing this thing. He already had most of the words for it. And it was just there.
Yeah, the guy's prolific. You know, man.
And I love that kind of thing because there's nothing in the way. That's not a business decision.
No.
That's a thing in his head that needs to write a song. And I love that.
Yeah.
That's my kind of people, you know.
Awesome, man. All right, man. So just to wrap it up, last question. And we can do this musically, but the best piece of advice ever given to you or a piece of advice you'd like to share that's really helped you along the way?
Just don't take it all so seriously. You know, I think that's one of the biggest problems. This isn't going to be a particularly short answer, but I'll try to keep
please.
It short. I don't like to get all philosophical and, you know, Dave King calls it the old man in the sea routine when you're up on your high horse, you know?
Yeah.
But I think one of the biggest problems that people have today is that they're way too fucking sure of themselves. They're way too aggressive about their opinions. There's no room for listening to anybody else. If you don't agree with me, you're a fucking idiot and you're blocked and you're deleted or canceled or whatever else. And it really is frustrating as hell to deal with. And I think in any profession, and you know, certainly in music and certainly in any kind of art, you can get through it all without making it the end of the world. You know what I mean? You got to keep some kind of perspective on what's going on here. You're only going to be here tops, what, 85 years, 90 years would be an old man.
Right.
You know, Christ, some people make it to 100, but that's still not much of a life when you think about it. You're not going to be around for all this other shit. You got to keep some perspective on what this is in the first place. You know, if what you're doing in life is to write songs and hang out with your mates and try to put something positive into the world, that's fucking great. Why not just keep doing that? Make that your thing and put as much work as you can into it. Try to make a living because we all got to make a living and pay the rent and all that. But try to work your world that way, you know, and don't take yourself so seriously. Don't take the whole thing so seriously because in the end, all that does is stop you from doing things and compromise. That's all that is. Mm. Because when you take it super, super seriously, that's when you're going to back away. And go, oh, well, I shouldn't do that because I don't want to rock the boat in this particular situation. Oh, fuck off. Mm-hmm. You know, rock the boat. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to be around for that much longer. And as long as you're not being a dick to people intentionally and you know, we all make our mistakes.
But sure.
As long as you're not out there actively trying to hurt people, you know, then what's the problem here?
Yeah.
You know, why do you have to be uptight about things? And I think, you know, it doesn't take long on any kind of social media or anything like that to see just how seriously people are taking life and themselves. Politics. When did we all start taking politics so goddamn seriously?
Right.
You know, politicians are clowns. What the fuck do we need to, you know, everybody's living with every moment of every politician and arguing about it. Your side is right. My side is right. This and that. Ah, you're an idiot. Oh my God.
It's fucking bonkers.
Who cares?
Right.
You know? Who cares? That would be my sentiment, I think. Lighten the fuck up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, man. Well, that's beautiful advice. Joel, thank you so much for taking the time,
Brian.
Brother.
No, thanks for coming
this
over,
This has been a blast. And everyone for listening, thank you so much. And we'll see you guys next week. Cheers.